612-543-2222 or visit hennepin.us/checkups. Residents outside Hennepin County should contact their county health department.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
March 1986, Jim Brandenburg was at the North Pole waiting on a bush plane. The Minnesota photographer was on assignment for National Geographic, and he had time to kill before his flight. So he decided to go for a walk through the Arctic half-light, when all of a sudden, out of the fog, came a pack of white wolves. In that magical moment, Brandenburg knew he wanted to do something for what he believed were one of the most misunderstood animals on the planet. That very same year, the photographer organized a series of concerts with the likes of James Taylor and Jackson Browne. The idea was to raise money to help reintroduce the gray wolf into Yellowstone National Park. Wolves had been hunted out of the park by the 1930s, and farmers didn't want them back. So these concerts were set up to compensate the farmers if wolves killed their livestock. Finally, in 1995, nearly 10 years from that day in the Arctic, Jim Brandenburg saw a dream realized when wolves were finally returned to Yellowstone.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota, and senior partner at the Dendros Group.
I'm Halili, owner of the Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers, and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate at Dendros Group.
And Luz Maria Frias couldn't be with us today, but we have a special guest today. She is somebody who was my first storytelling teacher. I don't know what to call you in community. Auntie Rose, Miss McGee, you've been so part and parcel to my formation of my identity, my Black identity, and that to be in particular. But we have none other than the Mrs. Rose McGee, who is joining us today to talk about some of the work that she's doing. So I just had to gush a little bit because in community, she's like one of the folks in community who can be like, Anthony, I need you too. And I've got my boots on before she finishes. So welcome to Counter Stories, Miss McGee. I ain't gonna call you Rose. So
I thank you for that, Anthony. Thank you very much. And I have to say, I appreciate you always saying yes whenever we call on you for whatever it is. So thank you so much.
Yeah. That's absolutely. So we are going to get into your background a little bit, but I wanted to just catch us up together. If you've been listening to Counter Stories, this February, we've been doing our kind of Black History Month treatment. And we began with the origins of Black History Month and let the conversation go where it went, because that's how we do on Counter Stories. We start and we go where the conversation and the spirit moves. Then the second episode, we dove into some, you know, if we're going to Google and think about what to look at, one of the aspects is looking at history, but we know that Negro History Week, as it began, was about not just looking at history, but not just looking at accomplishments, not just looking at individual people, but culture and concepts and ways of being that reimagine and repull African heritage identity back into the minds of folks for which that identity is being taken away. And we know that across so many identity intersections. And so today we're going to be talking about culture. And I thought that makes all the sense in the world to bring in somebody who has done a wonderful treatment of one aspect of our culture. And that is our sweet potato comfort pie. Miss McGee, you come to us wearing many hats, from the Humanities Center to your work with Sweet Potato Comfort Pies and looking at bringing our culture to bear in the areas and the events that matter. And so today we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the cultural things to explore in this reinvigoration that happens every February. Ms. McGee, if you will just talk a little bit about some of the work that you're up to, and then I'm going to bring us into this conversation about how Black culture should play into our observance of Black History Month.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Regarding the whole notion of Black history, it's interesting. What's on my mind today is a woman by the name of Addie Fisher. And Addie Fisher was the first Black person to have a cookbook published. And of course, in that cookbook is her sweet potato pie. And that's just sort of, you know, near and dear to my heart these days, obviously. But when I first learned about Mrs. Addie Fisher and her whole story around cooking Southern style, and it was published in 1893. It's just interesting, you know, to read. I wish I had it with me, how she measured things. You know how we talk about a pinch of this and just put in a little thimbleful of this. Okay, so what's a thimble and what's a pinch? And how do you know how to measure these things and make it just right? And even now, when I make a sweet potato pie, I don't use those measuring things. I just put it all in there. And it's kind of fun when we're doing a big batch of baking and people are like, well, are we going to measure? I'm like, no, you're just going to pour. And when I say stop pouring, you stop pouring. And then you're going to taste it and see how it is. And I have to tell you this, you talk about cultural differences, right? So the Minnesota Historical Society, actually it's Mill City Museum, had me come down a few weeks back, and the woman in charge, bless her heart, Winnie, she says, Rose, I tried my best to do it the way you do it, but I had to measure. And so she did. It was measured, and it really did taste delicious. I said, this is so good. So she says, well, it's your recipe. I said, yeah, but not with the measurements, but you did a beautiful job with that. So something as simple as that.
What I love about just that, and its connections to the original intent of Negro History Week, is that, you know, having a full-bodied celebration of all of us beyond the surface markers of culture, it's something that doesn't often get brought to the table in our observances, especially even if we manage to get beyond the big five that we talk about every year. And I like the way that well-known podcaster and social media Conscious Lee talks about this. He's often where we want to consume the culture without having any engagement with the community from which that culture comes from. I'm reminded of that most importantly in the work that I saw both during pandemic and through some of our racial unrest, in which you show that our culture, our being Black heritage, African heritage culture, can be a positive, is a positive way with which to deal with the everyday challenges of the world, which is not something that often gets represented. I'm just curious, you know, what you've seen in being able to, in this work and many, in your story circle work and so much work that you do in community, how you see our culture being an asset and salve to the everyday experiences of the world.
Well, call me a little fuddy-duddy if you wish, but when it comes to many of our aspects of culture, I still think that the best presenters and the best tellers of it, it comes from people themselves, right?
Oh, yeah.
I would not want someone to call me in and ask me to tell the story about the Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. I can share with you what I know about some things, but you need to bring in someone from the culture. And that is something that I don't know what's happening with our folks. We're with the people. When you know, I applaud you if you go out and you study and you learn all of these things, but don't act like you the authority on other folks' culture. And that's the piece that's starting to irritate me these days. It really is. And just understand how to be respectful and not act like, you know it all. So I remember when we took the pies down to Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, after the killings there. One of the reporters asked Bishop Goff, well, what do you think about this woman bringing all these sweet potato pies down here from Minnesota? And he looked at the reporter and he said, sweet potato pie? Why not sweet potato pie? That's who we are. That's us. And I thought, hallelujah, he gets it. He understands. And so that simple little thing there, I consider the sweet potato pie as being the sacred dessert of Black culture. And when we understand what sacred means when it comes to that which we identify with, then it becomes something that we want to protect. It doesn't mean that we want to keep it to ourselves, but we want to honor it in a way that it doesn't become over commercialized and taken for granted.
Miss McGee, if I was to jump in, because I'm thinking about my own experience and being an individual that's Native American and Black. And my father was from Des Moines. And so while I grew up in North Minneapolis in the Black community, it's the connections to my dad's family that I tended to experience more of what it meant to be Black, you know, and not misconstrue that. So when I think of my own experience and I think about the cultural types of things that I picked up as a youth, as a young man interacting with my cousins and uncles down in Des Moines, the thing that I have come to realize is that being Black is not a, or just like being Native American, is not a one thing fits all. It's, there are different kind of traditions and cultural ways and things that happen. There are many similarities, but there are a lot of differences. I didn't learn how to cook using measurements. I learned how to cook by seasoning to taste and watching my father. But there were certain things, you know, there were certain things he introduced on the menu that I realize now came more from that Black experience, like Black eyed peas and ham hocks and different types of mixtures that, you know, we grew up eating at the time that we just didn't know where it was coming from. You know, you weren't told that this was part of the Black experience. But there was one distinct meal my father made every year, and it was for New Year's. He would make spaghetti with greens, chitlins, and cornbread. Not the sweet cornbread, but the cornbread.
Right, you know,
And that was a distinct meal that we could count on for every New Year's. And I know that came from his parents. I don't know how anyone could, especially someone who studies, can say that they're could be an expert when it's so fluid. You know, I went with a friend of mine who's Black down to Parkin, Arkansas, and my experience down there was totally different than anything I've experienced up here. Mm-hmm. Totally different.
Oh yeah.
And your experience is going to be different than another Black person's experience, depending on where they live, when they grew up, yada da da da. But it's still the Black experience. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I said all that because I'm still waiting for some of your sweet potato pie.
Ooh. Well, yeah, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm on it. I got you. I heard the signal loud and clear. You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway with co-hosts Lee Lee and Don Eubanks, with special guest Rose McGee. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.
It is truly about the season. And that's the thing with most things that we eat. It's about how it has been prepared. And that's why we get so persnickety about who's what we'll eat. I only want so-and-so's coconut cake. I don't want so-and-so's potato salad. Nope, don't be bringing me anybody's fried chicken except my daddy's. I mean, that's how we are, right?
Yeah.
And that there's that endearing factor in there, as well as what's it tasting like? And then somebody else may come along and try something that somebody has just sworn up and down this is the only way it's to be, and go, oh, I don't think so. So it really is so much about how we have grown up, who it is that's prepared what. And you know, I can bring this little insertion in. I have a new book. It's a children's book, and it's called Can't Nobody Make a Sweet Potato Pie Like Our Mama. And it's really more about the story of these little children, they're twins, and their relationship with their grandmother and the lessons that are being taught. Anyone can read it and just feel something that they probably experienced themselves at some point. But I tell people all the time, mine may not be the best sweet potato pie to you. It's just the idea of making this dessert and giving it its honor, its propers, in terms of where it's been placed in our lives.
As someone who has gotten one of Rose McGee's sweet potato pies, but to be fair, I live across the street from where she works, so it was an easy thing for me.
That's fair.
And it was something that I took and I shared. And I've shared this story before, and I brought it to my mom. And me, my mom, and my niece, three generations of us, enjoyed the pie together. And so that sharing, you know, it was a way of making sweet potato that my mom had never known could be done. So we devoured that thing in one sitting. I think we saved a slice for my dad, because he was at work at the time. And so it is part of that sharing with each other, kind of the things that we love to eat, right? One of the things that people always ask me is, where do I get the best egg rolls? And I always say, my mom. Yes. That's, you know, I go to restaurants and people are like, should we order egg rolls? I'm like, no, they're never as good as my mom's egg rolls. I don't even try egg rolls at restaurants. Just, I know they're not going to be as good. And some people think that's really weird, but I think, you know, is just what you were saying, and with your new book, it's more than just the food, although it is technically, in my opinion, still the best.
We still got standards. Let's be clear. Like, there's still some standards you're going to hit.
But it is kind of also, you know, that experience of all of us around the big bowl, you know, rolling egg rolls, the propane tank in the garage so we can fry them. You know, it's a communal thing at the same time. And mm-hmm. with my community, at least, you know, now we have Hmong Town and Hmong Village and Hmong restaurants all over. We didn't have that when I was young. The only time we could get papaya salad was at the Hmong New Year at the Civic Center each year, you know? And so it was like, it was always a treat. It was always a treat to be able to go there and get those sorts of things, because otherwise you had to make it. And like you said, I'd only eat papaya salad from certain people, because certain people made it a lot better than other people. So it's always like, oh, who's bringing the papaya? Okay, I'll eat hers, you know. And it's still like that when I go to the Hmong Town or Hmong Village. I only buy papaya from specific stalls. But it was one of those things, like growing up, we didn't have, and now kids are just like, I want papaya, and then go out and get it on trash. You know, it was something that we never had.
It brings up, and this is actually a question that I've had for you, because I consider you, Ms. McGee, one of the culture keepers in my universe, right? In so much as not as you are the holder of all of the facts and all the ideas, but it's through you that I have gotten access to think about and engage with aspects of my own self and identity, and see that there's power and meaning to them. One of the cultural artifacts that you've produced, and this is to your point, Lee, that like there's meaning and there's story that helps you even reflect on your own cultural space. I see that as an asset. Black culture always throughout history has helped folks understand and digest and be proud of their own cultural space. What has been some of the conversations or engagements you've had so far this Black History Month that have been around kind of uplifting and helping remind folks of that culture?
Well, I'm, you know, excited about schools and what's happening in schools. In the Robbinsdale area schools, for example, for the third year, they are actually making sweet potato pie for the entire district as their dessert in every school in the Robbinsdale area schools. And I know the first year they did it, they contacted me and said, we would like permission to use your recipe if that's all right. And I said, it's absolutely all right. I'm very honored. And there were things that, you know, I was suggesting to them as tips to use, and the pie was delicious. Then last year when they did it, they actually invited me in to talk to all of their cafeteria managers across the district so that they would understand why they were making this. They didn't do that the first year, but somebody thought about it. It's probably some feedback from somebody saying, why are we doing this? And it was really great to sit down with them and explain to them why you're making this particular dessert. But it's also been equally gratifying to be in one of the schools during lunch and to hear and watch the students themselves. It was interesting to see other cultural groups engaged in it. Last year was a middle school that I went to. And so there was a group of African-born kids sitting together, and they were talking about how good it was, and they really enjoyed eating it. So that was a good thing to see. And they had not had sweet potato pie before, but they wanted to go back and get seconds. So that was a good, you know, sign. But it was just beautiful, first of all, that the district did see the relevance of it. So we actually have a curriculum around the whole sweet potato comfort pie process, and we have something called pie identity. So while the pie is cooking and baking and cooling off, they get a chance to examine themselves and what it is that's important to them and how much is impacting them. And the sad thing is, the top two things that keep coming up are bullying and racism. And this is what our kids are going through every day. Now, they also had a chance to present pies, and they did give pies to some of the staff, of course, but you know who they gave pies to a bigger number? You wanna guess who those kids decided they wanted to give a pie to more so?
The police.
They might. No. School bus drivers. The school bus drivers, that's who got the most pies. Isn't that interesting? And well, that was a beautiful thing to see as well.
There are so many experiences that we can go all the way around. And again, this isn't designed to be a catch-all for everything that you should know about Black history, but just the original imagination of Negro History Week was to be a place where we kickstart and rejuvenate our thinking and imagination, whether it's scholastic, scientific, cultural, artistic, whatever it is, around, you know, Black identity and imagination, especially since the first universities in the world are in the continent of Africa. The first eye surgeries occur in the continent of Africa. You have in the Georgia Sea Islands, a place where Black culture is insulated and new dialects, as you said, come forward because the plantation owners have to go back home off the island and leave you there. And so there's some insulation in the things that happen as a result of that. And so there's all these different tidbits that run through. I'm going to put your words back in front of you again, just because I've grown up with them so much. Just referring to your play, Kumbaya, the Juneteenth Story, you write into that some areas of tension that folks don't often talk about, especially historically, in particular, the tension between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, which many of us didn't grow up with this. We grew up with this kind of vanilla story of the great emancipator and the great orator, and we don't ever talk about the fact that the great orator was constantly challenging the great emancipator to actually emancipate when he was looking for every reason not to, and still preserve the United States. And so I'm curious about, as you think about, what are the tension points have come up for you?
You know, what's so interesting is I don't think much has changed in that regard. We have people who hold political offices and people who are in the decision-making roles, and there are advisors who come to them, right? And they may or may not listen, and yet they stick right there. They hang in there. We know them. We see them all the time. They're there. I mean, you know, we can name some of them. But the whole thing with that gets me, there's several things, because we know that Lincoln was signing a lot of stuff during that time. And one of those things he signed was also the execution of the 38 in Mankato area, right? All of that was under the same penmanship, is what we've been taught. And so the whole thing of that writing and that document doesn't sit well with everybody. And I can certainly understand why. And yet that language in there that talks about the gradual emancipation, it's like white people went so far as to say, okay, yeah, we'll free them, but we're not gonna let them go right away. We just gotta give them a little bit of time to get acclimated to their freedom. So they can't just be gifted it and just give them what they should have, but no, we'll give them gradual emancipation. These folks who are really supposed to be the great white liberals can sometimes be just as as those who are not, right? Because they think they're looking out for you by protecting you from their lens. And that is what we're kind of dealing with a lot these days too. And I can remember even back in my corporate days, remembering a job promotion that I didn't get because a brother, mind you, decided that no, she's single mom, she needs to be home. She can't do the traveling that's probably going to be required like the guys can do. And then it was like, oh, nothing to do with her not being capable of the job. I kid you not. It was all about his decision as to what I would be able to do being a single mom and not. And when I learned that, I was just livid because he was on that higher level to make that decision. And I had to go and confront him with that. And I, is it true? And he says, well, you know, I know this is a little difficult for you, but just think about it. Your children need you at home. And I'm like, wait a minute. Isn't that my decision to figure out how I'm going to take care of my children? But that mentality of that thing, and I'm like, you know, isn't that probably what somebody said about your black behind, because you are, and what are you doing? Well, you know, he's black. I don't think we should put him in that role because so-and-so. So it's just, there's so many levels in which that mentality applies that it definitely can bring on some tension and contention in conversations and the way that we act. So it still happens.
I wish the folks listening could see Don and Lee's face as you were telling that story, because we can see each other on Zoom, but you know it doesn't translate on audio. I'll leave us with this as we close today. In the words of Rose McGee, as she received her Facing Race Award, she says, "Through food and through relationships, we have sustained and overcome a lot. Pain is just something that has been a part of our lives for generations, but yet we survive." This has been Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church and partner of the Dendros Group.
I'm Haleigh, owner of the Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers, and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and Associated Dendros Group.
And our guest?
I'm Rose McGee. I'm president and founder of Sweet Potato Comfort Pie.
This has been Counter Stories, a co-production of the Counter Stories crew and Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota.